Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Oh, I always love the sincerity and the spontaneity of these openings. I'm really glad you're joining us tonight. Welcome to a special edition of the Kindling's Muse. This event is taped in front of a live audience at Bethany Community Church in Seattle, and it will be rebroadcast as podcast. And so many of you are listening to the podcast now and wondering the story. Well, that's it, in early December 2011. Tonight, it's a special show with my good friend, Eric Metaxas, and it really is kind of fun to do this.
I wouldn't go that far, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have fun tonight. Eric's going to do his usual Woody Allen kind of I'm miserable, but I'm here kind of New York thing. If you read Eric's bio, which some of you have, you know you're dealing with, shall we say, a rare bird. He is the author of the New York Times bestsellers on Bonhoeffer, William Wilberforce. In his bio, he points out that in a decidedly eclectic career, Eric Metaxas has written for VeggieTales, Chuck Colson, and the New York Times, three things not ordinarily in the same sentence. The Hartford Courant has declared figuring him out is like trying to stick a push pin in a cyclone. And I want you to welcome humorist, biographer, children's author, and even more, Eric Metaxas.
Thank you. Thank you. It is a pleasure. Yes, you know, it is a pleasure to be here. I hate to admit it, but I'm having fun already.
Yes, well, because we're talking about you.
Right.
And after all, it's about you.
Oh.
So.
He didn't know that he was mean.
I knew. I want to start with, if this was the life of, like on the biography channel.
Right.
We would start at the logical place, which is Eric Metaxas, the childhood years.
Right. But notice that this isn't one of those things.
Yes, I know, but
so
we're going to start there anyway. Here's my question, Eric. At what point did it become clear that you were destined for greatness? In your childhood.
It was like about 40 minutes ago, I think. it is an interesting thing. It's a good question. I don't think there's a good answer to it. But I definitely felt as a kid that, well, let me say this. I skipped first grade. And if you ever want to put pressure on a kid, you know, it's kind of like voted most likely to succeed or something. Because, you know, if you skip first grade, for the rest of your life, you feel like, well, I've got to do something. I was in such a hurry at age 6, you know, I had to skip that grade. So I feel like the rest of my life, I've been proving to myself and to my parents that that was a bad move, actually, that I should have never skipped first grade. Because I was a really, really early bloomer so that I could be a really, really late bloomer. But
you could just go back and do first grade again.
I could.
That's
in some ways, that's what this is about, Dick. So, but I had... I think that, I was always a good student. But it wasn't until I was in college that I really knew that I wanted to write. I almost immediately found myself just loving the great books. And it's interesting because I really did. I wasn't much of a reader as a kid.
Really?
No, I spent a lot of time watching Sanford and Son.
Yeah, that explains a lot right there,
and,
too.
And Welcome Back,
explains
Cotter.
Explains a lot.
Welcome Back, Cotter. Wow.
You know,
who needs the Aeneid when you've got Vinnie Barbarino? So I didn't spend all the time reading as a kid.
But
we're not a
love,
literary family.
Yeah, did you love words as a kid?
I loved a few words. But I forgot what they were. But I remember loving a few words at the time.
Yeah.
But no, I've always been verbal.
Well, you
always
learned most
verbal.
Of your words in the first grade.
Always been verbal. But my folks, I mean, I can say my parents are, you know, European immigrants. And so they came to this country and struggled. My mom came from Germany. My dad came from Greece. They met in an English class in Manhattan, in New York City, 1956.
Wow.
And you know, for them, they're children of World War II, and they struggled and whatever. So it's not like I grew up in a home where we played Scrabble or anything like that. But I always did have an affinity for the humanities, for words, for English as opposed to, say, math or science.
But it's really tough to play Scrabble when you don't know any words.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
It is.
So you loved them, but you didn't know any.
That's the problem.
Yeah, Scrabble was frustrating.
So yeah, we didn't spend a lot of time
reading. Did you
have
siblings? Do you have brothers and sisters?
Not that I know of. I have one brother.
Now
that
you mention it,
I do. I have a brother. His name is John. He's a year and a half younger than I am. He lives in Connecticut.
Yes.
And I love him. And as far as I know, those are the only siblings. It's just the one brother.
Okay. Yeah. So you were the oldest.
Technically, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's younger, so I guess I'm the oldest.
Were you humorous as a child? You're irrepressibly humorous.
I was
now.
Once I was humorous. It's like what you're saying. I mean, no. The answer really is no. But
It was a home with a Greek and a German and a lot of pressure.
Right.
And a lot,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are different kinds of humor. My mom. Now, this is really weird, right? My mom and my grandmother, who spent a lot of time with us, German. Okay. They weren't what you would call witty, right? But they were funny. There's a lot of kidding around.
Okay.
A lot of kidding around. So it's kidding around, joking, joshing, teasing, very healthy sense of humor, but not like highly developed sense of humor. I didn't really develop my sense of humor, until I was in college. I remember sort of
Let's skip ahead to college then, because this is getting boring.
Yeah.
The childhood years, in other words, is a blank. But we'll accept that.
You know, I should have mentioned, at age 15, I shot a cop in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah,
but because I was a juvenile,
time.
They let it
yeah.
go and stuff.
Okay,
but
yeah.
I don't want to get back into that.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
old.
That'll be
that's
in the
under
sequel.
The bridge. Under the bridge.
Yeah.
Actually, I shot a few people. But
so,
go ahead. Let's get to the literary stuff.
Why
yeah.
Yale? Why did a kid from these, you know, this home that's not literary and not,
yeah.
you know, why did you go to Yale?
Well,
how did that happen?
One thing that can be said of most immigrants, and certainly European immigrants, and certainly my parents, is that they are ambitious, and they push their kids. And so they pushed us. And so it's always, you know, to do the best. So I studied hard. I got good grades. I didn't go to Yale my freshman year. I went to Trinity College in Hartford. I was 16. I graduated early. As I said, it was kind of a strange thing. But I knew that I wanted to go to a big great university, and Trinity College was very small, and so I transferred in my sophomore year. And why? I don't know why. I think maybe I thought I'd have a political career and I should stay in Connecticut so that I could run for governor.
Were you really interested in politics already by that point?
I worked for the mayor of Danbury. When I graduated high school, I was, exactly, when I graduated high school, I was like the class day speaker, you know. And the mayor of Danbury offered me a job. So I started working. So I thought I was interested
in
politics.
What, like as a speechwriter?
No, as an intern, you know. But I suddenly got interested in politics. And I thought, and this cracks me up now, but at the time I thought, okay, politics, career in politics. And my freshman year, my major was poli-sci. And within about one course, I realized, I hate this. And I had a strong affinity in college for, I took a guided studies, it was called, which was really a hardcore humanities course, and instantly I fell in love with the Western canon. I just said, these are great books, this is great work. You know, I just started really? From the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I just knew that I wanted to be a part of this. I loved the idea of the meaning that was buried in the text and that you could talk about it. It just instantly captivated me.
That is amazing. So your literary thing really did just kind of happen explosively.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember, again, I had an affinity for that in sort of in high school, but it didn't, nothing happened.
Didn't
nothing
connect.
Became of it, no.
That's wild. At Yale, we're told, according to your bio, you made a literary splash as editor of the Yale Record.
Yes, I somehow knew that I liked humor, and it's such a strange thing. And I, the Yale Humor Magazine is really, really pathetic. And so, if something's really pathetic, it's easy to get like a job there, you know. And so, if I try to get a job at the Harvard Lampoon,
like on the Kindling's Muse,
that would have been much tougher. And so, I ended up working writing humor for the Yale Humor Magazine, which is the oldest humor magazine in the country, and. It was an amazing concept to be able to try to write funny, because everybody thinks they can write funny, But it's really hard, and we discovered that. And but it was a fun thing to be able to work on this and work with other people who are trying to be funny. It's pretty bizarre, but it was a great little education. I have to tell you, I got a lot of joy out of it. And
do you remember anything particularly that you wrote then that you're really fond of?
Really, really fond of. Let me see. No.
Okay.
It really is. It's so funny because you don't know what you're doing. I mean, humor writing is such a bizarre thing, and it was all just parodies of things. It was all about parodies. We did a parody of the Yale Daily News, and I wrote the headline for that. It was Cluck, 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 Chicken Men Inhabit Stacks. And that was all about chicken men taking over Sterling Library. that's one of the ones that I'm not fond of, by the way. But
it got a great audience response.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I mean, the people, like, it was hilarious.
I didn't give them permission to laugh. It was really serious. But it was a lot of parody. But it was a lot of fun. You know, you cut your teeth on parody, and so I.
Yeah. And you got some recognition.
I went on.
People, yeah.
I know I did, and I also knew that I wanted to write fiction, and I wrote, you know, I took a couple of short story classes, and I felt that I had an affinity for it. Like, you do something and you realize I'm getting affirmed, the professor is affirming me, and I've got a gift, and I don't know what I'm going to do with the gift, but I know that I have a gift, and it's a joy to do this stuff.
Now, you were invited to Yaddo, which is an amazing writing colony.
Yeah.
And unusual for someone to be invited at your age.
Yep. Yeah,
How did that happen?
I was like 22, I think.
That's amazing.
Youngest person there by at least a decade. It was really interesting because
it's mostly established writers, published
authors. Yeah, and I wrote, I'd written some fiction at Yale and then right after Yale. And yeah, the folks at Yaddo invited me to come. And it's an artist colony where you commit adultery if you're married and... You know, look it up. I'm not making that up. I was not married, and
so you didn't commit adultery.
I didn't commit adultery, but I have to say that
it's
kind of a scene. Like, it's kind of a scene. Like, people go there and you wonder, so what are they doing at this artist colony? And we're producing art, man. And in any case, it was interesting to be allowed to be there at that young age, and I really did have a strong desire to write fiction. There's no question about it. I thought my goal in life was to be a fiction writer, and I have failed.
I want to come back to that in a minute.
That was meant
to be a joke also.
There is
this upstaging Dick Cavett story.
Right.
What was that?
Well,
and by the way, not everybody may know who Dick Cavett is, but he is an amazing humorist, and he hosted a talk show that was very thoughtful. I mean, he did some of the best work out there.
Yeah, well, and he was hugely famous in the 70s, mainly in the 70s and 80s, but he was the class day speaker when I graduated from Yale. I think Harvard got the King of Spain and we got Dick Cavett. And and I think we won on that, you know, to be honest. But because I've become friends with Dick Cavett, and the King of Spain won't return my phone calls. But I have become friends with Dick Cavett. And the day that I met him in 1984, I was chosen to be the class day speaker with a friend of mine. We were the editors of the Yale Humor magazine, and nobody else could write a funny speech. So we wrote these funny speeches, so we were unanimously chosen to be the speaker, so we got to sit on the stage with Dick Cavett, and we gave our funny speech loaded with inside jokes, which, you know, everybody is howling because it's all inside jokes that we're telling on professors or whatever it is. And then Dick Cavett came up, and he did a good job, but I think it's hard to beat when somebody's got the inside track. It's hard to come from
the
outside.
And that cluck, cluck, cluck thing went over really
big. That was huge. In its day, it was unparalleled. Yeah.
But that's interesting because you did meet Dick Cavett, mm-hmm. and you made an impression on him.
I don't think I did, actually. I don't know where you got that idea, because I didn't make an impression on him.
Well, all these years later, you were invited to his 75th birthday.
But he doesn't know I'm the same person. You see. That was no impression on him. I can tell you, it was about 15 years after that that I finally buttonholed him and got to know him.
Yeah.
And so I do know him now. He's a friend, a very dear man, brilliant, brilliant guy. We did a Socrates in the City recently. I won't get into that because that's future, but we did a Socrates in the City event where I interviewed him kind of like this, but with nicer tables. And never mind.
Where did your spiritual journey towards Jesus become part of your story?
I was raised in the Greek Orthodox Church, which is basically an ethnic experience, a cultural experience. I mean, a lot of people have that experience. You go to church because it's what you do, and you know, for Greeks, the experience of growing up as a Greek American, most Greeks go to the church. But for me, it wasn't a really religious experience. It was a cultural experience. It's what you do because you're Greek. And by the time I graduated, I didn't have any particular hostility toward it because these were wonderful people I grew up with. But they weren't evangelicals. They weren't serious about Jesus or the Bible. So I went to Yale, and Yale is so aggressively secular humanist that, you know, by the time I graduated, I was sure that having any kind of Christian faith is this parochial thing that you abandon once you, you know, move on into the cultural elites of Manhattan or wherever I thought I was going, that, you know, you kind of leave that, and that's for ethnic people and maybe some minorities and people who need a crutch, but it's for people like me. Oh, no, we're way past that, you know. And most people where I live today in Manhattan, it's kind of the zeitgeist of that world, that you just don't take that seriously. And so I graduated with no real beliefs, but I didn't do anything to distract me from wondering what's the meaning of life. Most people get a good job or do something. I just floundered and tried to be a writer, and I'm not recommending that, by the way. And after I stopped floundering, I drifted for a while, too. So, I was not
just
happy.
Just for the halibut.
I was not, I was not happy, and ultimately, I was trying to be a writer, and not really succeeding, frankly. I went to Yaddo, and I had published something in the Atlantic Monthly, but basically it wasn't working. My writing plans were you know, I had shown great promise, and nothing was coming of it. And I was depressed. I ended up moving back in with my parents, which I don't recommend. I specifically don't recommend moving in with my parents because they will eat you alive, and they have the European immigrant attitude, like, you know, we worked our whole lives, we didn't go to college, we worked so that you could go to Yale, and now you're floundering around and you don't know what to, like, let me help you out, get a job. So it was a really harsh time, and I struggled with depression and all. It was a hard time, and in the middle of all this, I got a menial job to support my non-writing, pseudo-writing habit. I got a job as a proofreader at Union Carbide in Danbury, Connecticut. And
scintillating.
Yes. And the Aramaic word, I think, is Gehenna, is the word. And thank you for being a biblically literate crowd. Thank you. Explain that to your neighbors. And it was awful. I was like, I had a little cubicle about a quarter mile from the nearest window. You know, it's like one of those kind of horrible, horrible situations. And in the midst of this hell, a man appointed by God befriended me and started sharing with me about the Bible, and he knew the scripture well, and he starts really being, in a winsome way, sharing his faith with me. And I had been inoculated at Yale against this kind of thing. I thought, well, I don't, you know, the Bible, and that's one of these weird Christians, I don't want to hear about it, whatever. But I was in enough pain to be a little bit open. And so the conversation continued and continued, and it went on for months. And in my pain, I just was every now and again open to the idea that this might be true. This might be true. I don't know. I doubt it, but maybe, I hope there's something true. And then one night, like right around my 25th birthday, I had a dream. I won't tell that story now. I can tease it by saying if you go to my website, which is ericmetaxas.com, there's a video done by Redeemer Presbyterian Church, which is a really spectacular little video they made where I tell the story of the dream. But I had a dream where basically Jesus reveals himself to me. It's an amazing, amazing dream. That's the subject of a whole thing. And I accepted Jesus dramatically. It's like going to sleep single and waking up married. I was totally different, and I've never been the same. And I can't explain it. It's like I thought this only happens to Muslims. How do you? I had a dream. I mean, I'm supposed to walk the sawdust trail, and you know. But no, somehow it just happened to me. It was an experience of total grace, and it's kind of. I mean, it's like Lazarus. How much faith did Lazarus have? You know, he was a corpse, none. And so I was spiritually dead, and God just, you know, sovereignly touched me and changed me, and. Wow. Gave me the gift of faith in Jesus Christ. I remember telling the guy that had been sharing his faith with me, my buddy Ed Tuttle, I said, I had this dream. And he says, what do you think it means? I said, I've accepted Jesus. And I knew that it was, wow. I was a new person. And that really, from that point on, it's, you know.
So how did that change your career aspirations? You were trying to be
well.
The next
I was a
great
button man for the mob. Did I mention that?
Yeah.
Yes.
We got,
and I realized that's not going to work. You can't be a Christian button man for the mob. So maybe a bag man for the mob. No, you can't do that either. So no. What happened was I instantly knew that there is a God, He loves me, and He has a plan for my life, and whatever I've been doing hasn't been working too well, and so I really dramatically gave Him my life and my career, and I said, Lord, in fact, I remember specifically saying, unless You move me out of this job, this dead-end, proofreading, horrible job, I will stay here waiting on You until You move me out.
Wow.
And several months later, I remember thinking, okay, maybe I'm supposed to be here for a while. This is some experience I'm supposed to have or whatever. And I suddenly was told I was laid off, totally out of the blue. Literally the same day, I was handed half of my annual salary in two incredible writing jobs. It was a total miracle. I mean, I was laid off 7 hours later, handed a job as a writer for a company called Rabbit Ears Productions, which I thought they would give me some like little nickel and dime writing jack a copy or catalog copy, but they handed me these two amazing projects totally without warning. So it was just God sovereignly picking you up and putting you in something else. So I started writing children's books and getting nibbling around the world of entertainment and writing scripts and things, and it was an extraordinary experience, and so
and
that launched me into
that world. Some of the
people
involved were like Mel Gibson, and I mean, it was amazing.
Well, I didn't get to hang with Mel or anything, no, but I did write scripts
that were read.
They were read by Mel Gibson, Jodie Foster, anybody you can think of. I mean, practically everybody in Hollywood did Rabbit Ear stuff. So yeah, I got to write this stuff for them, and it just launched me in the world of children's books, and also it's interesting because it was kind of, you know, when I say people think children's books, but it was really adapting fairy tales and folk tales, and so it had a real literary quality to it.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. And that's some of the best work I've done. I'm very proud of the work I did for Rabbit Ears, but I never in a million years would have chosen that. And that's what I find funny, is that I pray this prayer and God just intervenes and says, okay, let me hear. And it ends up that this was a great thing, but I never ever would have chosen it.
And you've continued to write children's
I have. Stuff. I mean, I'm not a children's book writer, but I've written children's books. Obviously, I had a job working for VeggieTales for a while and stuff. So it's just something I do. I've never met a genre I didn't like.
No, I know that. How did you end up writing for Chuck Colson at Breakpoint?
Let's see. I was, after I had the job with Rabbit Ears, which was kind of fun, I eventually got ill. I've had chronic fatigue, health issues my whole adult life, really. And so I eventually kind of got laid off and was trying to be a writer again and floundering and drifting, except as a Christian, which is really about the same. And except that, actually, that's not true. I'm glad I can joke about that, but that's not true. It's not at all the same, because you know that God's got your back and He's with you, and He's with you in it, in the difficulty. But I was going through a tough time and eventually got engaged to my current wife. And I realized, you know, I need some kind of a job, like a job. So I got a job in advertising, and it was one of the worst years of my life. I spent a year working at a horrible ad agency. I won't mention the name, but if I were to mention it, it's Gray Advertising. And just doing the most boring stuff. I wrote one TV ad. In a year, I wrote one ad for TV. Can you guess the product? X-Lax. That's true. So this horrible, horrible year. And in this year, I'm praying.
That's true, really?
That's true.
You worked a year on an X-Lax commercial.
Well, you didn't work a whole year on it, but
it's supposed to make things go faster, not slower.
Yeah, I was waiting
product,
for that.
Actually.
Thank you for that.
Maybe you didn't understand
that
the product
good.
Concept.
So, but in the year, the funny thing is that in this miserable year, I mean, it's my first year of marriage. I'm working with this horrible, horrible job. And of course, I'm praying, Lord, lead me. I hate this. What is this, you know? And long story short, suddenly I get a phone call or something like that there's a job, you know, Chuck Colson's looking for a writer for Breakpoint Radio, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, that's that. You know, I love Chuck Colson. He's a hero. I love him. And I was thrilled to get to work for him for 2 years. That was just one of the joys of my life.
And so you were writing for Breakpoint?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, you kind of collaborate on stuff. You come up with ideas. He comes up with ideas. It's kind of a fun It's a fun thing. I mean, that was actually very hard as well. I shouldn't say it was really fun. In some ways, it was fun, but it was actually quite hard Yeah. But it didn't pay well, so that makes up for it.
Yep, got it. Biography. Some people are now starting to think you as a biographer. You've done William Wilberforce. You did Bonhoeffer. You did Squanto.
Yeah.
And yet you don't think of yourself particularly as a biographer, but that's been a part of your writing.
Well, yeah. I think, I can say I feel God called me to write these two biographies. And these are two very, very special men who speak to us, who I think speak to this generation. If I could, I would give a free copy of each of those books to everybody on the planet, because I really believe these two stories are for us. And so I feel God called me to write them, and I wrote them, but I don't feel any ambition to write other biographies. Everywhere I go, people say, I got an idea for your next book, or I got an idea, and I have to say, I just don't, any more than I feel a burning passion, I've got to write kids' books or whatever. I've got to do what I've got to do, but I don't feel that I stick to a genre like
well,
that.
Well, what's interesting is today we've spent some time together, and hearing your story now with these different pieces again, you really do get to a place where you say, okay, you know, you do a bit of work, and it's good, but that's not what you want to do forever. You want to know what's next, and sometimes God waits to let you know what it is, but yeah. It comes just in time for you. I mean, the call comes.
I guess.
Which leads me to my next question. Tell me what it has been like for success, recognition, and financial stability to come so easily in your life.
Yes. Well, I have to say, without any doubt, and this is the way it is. I mean, a lot of you, especially the older folks here, you understand life is tough. If you don't understand life is tough, it's because you're foolish. Life is tough, and walking through tough life with God makes it a lot less tough. And for me, I can say without a doubt, my writing career and the whole thing, it has been a real struggle. It's been brutal. In many ways, it's just been really, really tough. I mentioned before I've had health issues, and to try to be a writer to begin with is tough. To try to be a writer who's a, sawed-off, born-again Jesus freak is also tough. Did I mention that I'm a Christian? And to try to be doing that and living in New York City and to have certain ambitions and goals, it really has been a huge, huge struggle. So the Bonhoeffer book is the first time that I have felt something has really hit and been a success. I mean, from the outside, people might think, oh, but Amazing Grace or whatever. Trust me, folks, it's just been a financial struggle because, you could, to live in New York's expensive, and it's just been tough. So this book, there's no way I could ever express how grateful I am to God for the blessing of this book. There's just no way. The Lord knows that I know that it was the Lord that has blessed this, because you can work really hard and still nothing can come of it. And folks know you can struggle and struggle and struggle. There's no promise of success. So for me, this year, finally, really, the idea that this book has hit has stunned me and just blessed me to my bones. I'm just really grateful to God.
Well, and there's a whole bunch of people here that are grateful that you wrote it too, because it's been a gift to us, just as God gave you that gift to write it. We're going to be back with more of Eric Metaxas. We're going to talk about Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer right after this. This is Dick Staub. You're listening to The Kindling's Muse in a special edition, The Life and Times of Eric Metaxas. And we'll be coming back right after our X-Lax commercial. Don't go away. Well, welcome back. This is Dick Staub, and our special guest tonight is Eric Metaxas. You're listening to Kindling's Muse, and we've been talking a little bit about his life and journey. And I do recommend that you go see the video of the dream that Eric had. And
Let's get a plug-in for ericmetaxas.com. Yeah. Actually, if you go before the end of the week, you get a bowl of free bowl of soup. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's one of the few websites that offers soup. It's internet soup, so it doesn't taste great, but But you get a free bowl of soup if you visit ericmetaxas.com.
The biography thing. How did the Wilberforce thing happen?
The biography thing. Yeah, let me tell you how the biography thing happened.
Yeah, okay.
Dick.
Yeah.
Let me tell you.
I didn't go to Yale.
You really know these literary terms, don't you?
Yeah.
It's obviously you've interviewed some of the finest authors in the world because you're just bringing your game here, and it's. let me tell you about the biography thing. I was actually okay. So I
wrote. Could have said thang.
A thang. You could. That's true. That's true. Thing is a step up from thang. Wow. Let's see. I worked for VeggieTales. Actually, I gotta say what I did for VeggieTales. Do you mind if I say what
no,
I did?
No, please.
Okay, not much.
But they could also go to ericmetaxas.com.
That's
but
true.
Go ahead.
That's true. But I hate to plug ericmetaxas.com.
Yeah. But I have found ericmetaxas.com very useful in my personal life.
Have you really? If I found ericmetaxas.com as useful as you had, I'd be plugging it right now. But I wouldn't. So, no, when I was at VeggieTales, I just have to say, because people say, what did you do for VeggieTales? People think I invented Bob the Tomato, and I didn't, you know. But I did have the privilege of writing some stuff for them.
This inspiration for the creation of it.
That's not true.
Okay.
No. I just had the privilege of working there for a while, but I was the voice of the narrator on the Esther video. Oh. Now you're tuned
in. Can you give us a line from
it? Shame on you. I could, but I shan't. But actually, I was the narrator on the Esther video, and I did such a good job that to this day, I am still the narrator on the Esther video. If you listen to a DVD, you could go home tonight. I'm still on there. So I'm the narrator of the Esther video, and I'm a narrator, so it's a vegetable universe, so I am not pictured, but you know that somehow the narrator has to be some kind of vegetable. But we don't know what kind of vegetable, but I think broccoli, Rob. I'm not telling you what to think, but I think that's the kind of narrator that I was. And also,
has
I
this
was
been painful for you to not know what vegetable you are?
Oh yeah, I lie awake at night thinking about that. I also had the privilege of writing half of Lyle, a Kindly Viking. I wrote the Hamlet omelet parody, the only VeggieTales Shakespeare parody ever written. I had the privilege of doing that. So that's what I did, right?
That Yale education did not go to waste.
So I wrote X-Lax, I worked for Chuck Colson, I did VeggieTales, and then I floundered again, another season of floundering, and I ended up, I always wanted to write, let me put it this way, when I became a Christian, part of my feeling, even to this day, is that we live in a really strange culture where I thought, how is it that what is true about the Christian faith is not exactly something you're going to find on NBC, or it's just not out there. And I thought I wanted to share my faith with my friends and neighbors, and I was looking for the kind of a book where you could do that, and I couldn't find anything that I liked. Now, there are great books, but they weren't the kind of thing my friends would read. You could give my friends a copy of Chesterton's Orthodoxy or Mere Christianity or whatever, and they go, oh, thank you very much, but they're not going to read it. And I thought, could we write something that maybe they would read? And so I wrote a book called Everything You Always Want to Know About God, But We're Afraid to Ask, which is a ridiculous title. But I followed it up with a sequel called Everything Else You Always Want to Know About God, But We're Afraid to Ask. And then a third in the trilogy, Everything You Always Want to Know About God, But We're Afraid to Ask, the Jesus Edition, which is true. So anyway, I wrote this book. The reason I'm saying this is that, well, first of all, it's kind of a fun Q&A apologetic. So it's
I've read it.
You've read it, thank you. Yeah. So it's using some humor to communicate the basics of the Christian faith. And I thought, even if you don't agree with it, you should know what it is, right? People should have some sense of what the Bible says or doesn't say, whatever. But the first book, I put in a paragraph, no more than a little paragraph, like a chapter heading, about William Wilberforce as a guy who took the Bible seriously and consequently changed the world by abolishing the slave trade. And so I just put a paragraph in there, and I found myself one day on CNN talking to a national TV audience about this book, Everything You Want to Know About God, But Afraid to Ask, because as you know, CNN every week has loads of a Christian apologists on there talking about the faith and sharing the good news with the audience. And that week it was me. Or was it I? I don't know. Usually it's nobody. And I was there that week, and I find myself being asked the weirdest question. I was really like expecting hard, you know, hardball questions. And I was expecting the host to say, well, how can a good God allow suffering? What do you say to that, you know? And instead I got the softball question, which I was not prepared for. And the softball question was, what's this here about William Wilberforce? This seems very interesting, this paragraph about Wilberforce. Can you tell us about Wilberforce? And suddenly, I'm on a national, you know, with national exposure talking to America about Wilberforce. I mean, it was completely out of the blue, bizarre, and I just share a tiny bit, which leads to a publisher contacting me and saying, by the way, there's a movie coming out called Amazing Grace about the life of William Wilberforce. Would you like to write a biography to go along with the movie? And they were offering $8 an hour. And I thought, wow, as a writer, you know, man, that's some serious coin. So, and that's why you need an agent. I had an agent. He got me $8.25 an hour. And
and then he took 15%, yes, yes, which got you and, down below $8.
Right, exactly. Thank you very much for stepping on my punchline. Thank you. And so basically, I found myself writing this biography of William Wilberforce. And in the course of it, that was very, very tough. But it has a literary quality, something about that era, and I enjoyed it and whatever. And inevitably, I would go around the country talking about Wilberforce. I give talks on Wilberforce. And people kept asking me, who will you write about next? Who will you write about next? Some people said, about whom will you next write? And which, whom really is a word. If English is your first language, you might want to brush up on the word whom, because it really still... I don't mean to intimidate you, but you really need to be using whom. And it's in many cases, it's the correct word. And in the objective case specifically, it's the correct word. So, Eric, about whom will you next write? Who will you write about next? I kept hearing this over and over and over again. And I thought, you know what? There is one person, if I were ever to write another biography, because I'm looking for a career writing biographies, but I would... Potentially, if I were to write another one, I would write it about Bonhoeffer. Now, why Bonhoeffer? Because the summer that I came to faith, the man who was sharing his faith with me gives me a copy of The Cost of Discipleship and says, have you ever heard of Bonhoeffer? And I said, no, I've never heard of Bonhoeffer. You know, I went to Yale. They don't tell you about heroes of Christian faith at Yale. I'm sure at all the other Ivies they do, but I know Brown is big on Moody. And So all the students dress up as Moody. It's amazing. And but I was at Yale where they don't tell you anything about that kind of stuff. And so I remember saying to my friend, like, no, I've never heard of Bonhoeffer. Who's Bonhoeffer? And he says, oh, Bonhoeffer's a German pastor and theologian who got involved in the plot to kill Hitler, spoke out against the Nazis, was killed by the Nazis in a concentration camp. And as a German, as somebody who grew up, you know, in the shadow of World War II and the stories from my mother losing her dad and all that stuff, I was astounded by this. And so it really captured my heart in the summer of 1988. And all these years later, after the Wilberforce thing, I thought, if I were to write a second book, Bonhoeffer, that story needs to be told. But I didn't have a clue, honestly, beyond the basics. It's not like I had some great sense of who Bonhoeffer was.
Right.
I knew the basics.
Which is amazing, because when you got into the Bonhoeffer book, you didn't realize it, but the contract called for a 60,000-word book.
And, right. And I delivered 240,000 words.
Yeah, 240,000 words, which meant you changed publishers.
That means I'll give you 180 for free. It's a freebie. I'm just throwing it in. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, but part of the reason the book got that big was you got that passionate about it, and you saw the story, and you learned more and more. And because I remember when you were writing that book, you were like, you were...
Bleeding.
Well, you were overwhelmed with what you were learning and writing and... It was an obsession.
Yeah,
it was a useful
amazing.
One for all of us.
It was amazing. I have to say, I had no idea what I was getting into, and I thought it would be, you know, about as long as the Wilberforce book. The Wilberforce book is 100,000 words, and I thought, okay, so I'll write about that. But as I got into it, I can't say what it was, but it just, I guess to me, it's like you've got a job to do, and the job is to tell the story. And to tell the story well, you know, as you're telling a story, you realize, well, this is really important, and this is important, and that's important, and I need to give this some context and explain the situation, what's going on in Germany. And so in the course of telling the story, it became longer and longer. And I have to say that, you know, I wanted to do the job right. It was not about writing a long book or a short book, or it was just about telling the story right. And the story had not been told for over 40 years.
Right.
The great book by Eberhard Bethge, who is Bonhoeffer's friend, was, you know, it's 1,100 pages, and it's written by his friend, and it's its own thing. And I thought, I want to tell the story anew for a new generation. And in the course of doing that, yes, it grew to 240,000 words. I eventually trimmed it back to a brisk 220,000 words. But it's a much longer book than the publisher was interested in at the time.
Yeah, but that all turned worked together for good. We won't get into that whole story.
Yeah.
But it wasn't feeling like it at the time, which is a no. word of encouragement for
me. Well, it's kind of like saying the crucifixion worked out really well because then there's a resurrection. But it doesn't mean, you know.
Yeah. Eric, comparing yourself to our beloved Savior's a bit much.
I wasn't comparing myself to our beloved Savior. I was comparing the work of this book to the crucifixion.
Okay, fair enough. I just reread the Bonhoeffer book, and the thing that amazed me about it is how Bonhoeffer had a clarity of what was happening around him, which few people did.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing to me. I mean, I really meant it when I said that I went into this pretty ignorant. I knew the basics.
Yeah.
And so I'm sifting through this stuff, and you think, wow, this guy has a prophetic aspect to his life. He sees things that others don't see. Why does he see it? And then he speaks about it. He tries to wake people up to let them know what he is seeing and to say, look, do you see what I'm seeing? Look, you've got to, you know, try to get people. And that's what prophets do. They don't make stuff up. They see what is there, but nobody else sees it. And they try to draw our attention to it. And often we don't pay attention to it. But Bonhoeffer had a real gift. And he saw things that almost nobody at that time saw.
And took stands. I mean, it's how many of you have read the Bonhoeffer book already?
Oh, you can leave. You guys can leave because we're going to just rehash the plot. Yeah.
No, I mean, the rest of you, it really is a book you need to read because
you certainly need to purchase it. Let me put it that way. But I just joke around. Yeah. Everybody says they're daunted by the size. This is no joke, and I can say this to you because you're a friend. Don't listen for a second. But no, seriously, I have hundreds of times heard people say, I was initially daunted by the size, but when I started reading it, I couldn't put it down.
Most people don't use the word daunted.
I have heard that hundreds of times. And as a writer, that's the greatest thing you ever dream, that somebody says, I couldn't put it down. But I've now heard that hundreds of times. So I guess it must be true. And I would say that Bonhoeffer's story is so compelling that once you get into it, you just, you know.
Well, yeah. I think it's compelling, and I really believe that it is timely. I mean, if you look at both Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer, they were both in cultural situations of crisis, turmoil, uncertainty.
Yeah.
And there were very few people seeing clearly, speaking clearly, and then living based on their convictions. And you wrote about two people that did.
Yeah.
And in the case of Bonhoeffer, it's so recent. It's part of our really recent history.
Yeah.
And
I was with a woman last week who knew Bonhoeffer. It's an amazing thing that there are people alive who, I mean, she was young, but in fact, it was just a week ago, I had tea with the younger sister of his fiance, who lived through this. And I'm talking to her, and she's telling me little things that you can't believe that you have the privilege to talk to somebody who knew this man.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is quite recent.
We're going to let the audience ask questions about Bonhoeffer, because so many of them have read it, but suffice it to say, it's a book well worth reading. But there's another book that just came out, Socrates in the City. And what is the concept behind Socrates in the City? What is this thing?
Well, I wanted to do something a little different. For example, Bonhoeffer has a plot, Socrates in the City, no plot. I shouldn't joke.
Not the book, but the events.
Yeah, let's
start with the events.
This I have to explain. The book, let me explain the events first so you'll understand what the book is, because otherwise it's confusing. For 11 years in New York City, in Manhattan, I've run a speaker series called Socrates in the City, where, as you know, Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. And I thought, let's have something in New York City. A friend of mine wanted me to have a seeker's Bible study. And I was thinking about this and thinking about this. And eventually, I had the privilege of hanging out with Oz Guinness. And he said, well, I could come and speak about some topic or whatever. And I thought, wouldn't that be great to have a speaker series where in New York City, of all places, where you never get somebody like an Oz Guinness showing up, let's get Oz Guinness or Chuck Colson or Francis Collins or people to share from a biblical perspective, let's say, about the big questions of life. So we say, it's called Socrates in the City, Conversations on Life, God, and Other Small Topics, right? So the meaning of thank you. So it's meant to be, an exploration of all the big questions that you're not going to talk about in a cocktail party in New York City, but that everybody's asking. And I always, I have the privilege of finding these amazing speakers and thinkers, and we had Sir John Polkinghorne, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, who's a Christian, talking about the relationship between faith and science. So we've had all these amazing, great minds, and I always introduce them with a lot of really stupid humor, and that's intentional, I think. But it sort of lightens the tone so that it's not a ponderous intellectual exercise, so it's actually fun. And so the speaker doesn't feel like, oh, this is really heavy. And it's meant to be fun, because we know that the big questions, at least I know that the big questions have great answers. I don't have to be afraid to discover that the meaning of life is that life has no meaning and kill yourself.
Let me tell you this.
So there you go.
I think this book, and by the way...
I didn't explain that it's a book yet.
I'll do that for you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Right. There is a book out now, and he'll explain more about it in just a minute. Sorry. But I'll give a really simple version, which will use words like thing. It's got Polkinghorne, Peter Kraft, Paul Wietz, Father Richard John Neuhaus, John Bethke Elstein, Chuck Colson, N.T. Wright, Alistair McGrath, Oz Guinness, Francis Collins, and they give these lectures, and this book has these. But what I want to tell you is that the price of the book alone is worth the introductions, because every one of these chapters includes the introduction that Eric gives of the speaker. Now, I've emceed a lot of events, and my own style is to try to quickly get through the introduction, because I figure people don't want to hear me, they want to hear the speaker, and that's always true. And so I'll wrap this up really quickly. No, I'm not into giving big, big, big introductions and reading their resume and all that stuff. I mean, you're here to hear the person. Eric, when I started reading this book, and I thought, oh my gosh, he included the introduction. And the introduction is long.
Long, yeah.
I mean, the speaker's sitting there waiting to get up there, and Eric is like, you know, the speaker's... But actually, a number of these speakers will say that, as a matter of fact, Chuck Colson, this book, said... After the introduction, he said, usually when I'm introduced, people are reading off my resume, and it's boring, and I can't wait for them to get done. He said, Eric's introduction was so amazing that I really didn't want him to stop. And then the audience says, no, we wanted him to stop. We'd like you to speak now. But let me give you an example of some of the lines that Eric throws in. Each show, he is describing Socrates in the city. And you know, you're expecting a really sophisticated, this is New York, sophisticates. One of them
actually,
is...
Actually, I'm going to interrupt to say that. This is always held in a really fancy club.
Yeah.
Even fancier than this, I think, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
But seriously, these like private clubs, and there's wine and hors d'oeuvres and piano. It's very fancy, elegant environment. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's Eric saying, before I say more, perhaps you don't really know what Socrates in the City is. Let me explain. We are a UFO cult. There, I said it. And you got to picture John Polkinghorne, who has no idea what he's gotten himself into. This world-famous physicist. And Polkinghorne said in an interview in Time that when he was honored in a certain way, you could have knocked him over with a feather. So Eric expands this into his surprise that the world's leading physicist doesn't understand that you can't actually knock someone over with a feather. And he said, maybe an ostrich feather, an emu, maybe, but this is what this man does. To these sophisticates sitting there ready to speak. Here's another one. Welcome to Socrates in the City, the thinking person's alternative to doing macrame and decoupage. Hi, I'm Eric Metaxas. Welcome to Socrates in the City, the thinking person's alternative standing in front of the Trump Tower and having your picture taken. Good evening and welcome to Socrates in the City, the thinking person's alternative to having yourself surgically altered to look like a jungle cat. Now, of course, that was after the story came out about the guy that had actually done that.
I don't know.
And then finally, this one. For those of you who are new to Socrates in the City, we're, of course, a society of jugglers and magicians who gather to share tips on juggling and magic and to make fun of David Blaine. Now, Eric, not everyone would introduce these amazing world-class thinkers this way.
I'm sorry. I won't do it again. I apologize.
No. I know you will do it again. And it's brilliant. I'm serious. Everybody's got to buy a copy of the book tonight. You should give it as a gift, because in addition to the great lectures you're going to read, which are timely.
They're great lectures.
And
I will tell you that.
They're
fantastic, yeah.
I'm serious. And I say this painfully, that Eric's introductions are just amazing. And they truly are worth the price of the book.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, now what do you want to tell us about the book?
That wasn't so bad, right? I paid him $40 to say that. So, but I have to say that I think that we really do live in a culture where people are afraid to ask the big questions or whatever. And so Socrates in the City, we have amazingly succeeded. We've done this for 11 years, and we get these huge crowds. We charge money, and it's really a fun event, and it thrills me to think that that's the case. We've got Bill Bennett actually speaking next Thursday, and we totally mix it up and get different people, and it's not always about God or whatever. I like to confuse people enough so that they're forced to pay attention. And so it's not like predictable that it's going to be this kind of a Christian speaker. We really sort of mix it up, and we have a lot of fun. But it has been terrific, and I kept thinking someday we've got to put it into a book. And it was very tough to pick the 11 that are in this book. Was incredibly tough, because we've had 60 talks over the years, and there's a whole bunch of great ones that we just couldn't fit in. So I hope
One of the subjects was, can an atheist be a good citizen?
Yeah.
That's a really provocative question. It's a thoughtful question. And N.T. Wright did Simply Christian, Why Christianity Makes Sense. Alistair McGrath, The Twilight of Atheism. Oz Guinness, The Case for Civility. Of course, it's Francis Collins, The Language of God. Just amazing, amazing content. And I personally believe, and this is the Kindlings is about rekindling the intellectual, spiritual, and creative legacy of Christian culture. And I'm a person that believes that there is a real hunger for better thinking and better articulation of ideas that matter. And I am just so proud of Eric that he's taken this on in New York City and has done this amazing service to the city and has brought these world-class thinkers and has really interesting folks showing up to hear these lectures.
Yeah. We've had a number of celebrities show up over the years.
Yeah.
Tina Louise, Ginger from Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, I know.
She showed up.
Yeah.
That's true. No, we've actually had quite a bit. You never know who's going to be there.
But, I mean... So that book has just come out. So we're gonna in just a second go here to some questions and answers, and you can ask anything you want about Bonhoeffer, about Wilberforce, about the Socrates in the City book, and of course you can ask anything you want about Eric Metaxas, which I'm sure that's where most of our questions are going to center. There's a lot of confusion about Eric Metaxas, but let's look forward to getting back to that in just a minute. We'll get back with questions and answers from our audience. I do have to say, one of the introductions in the book is Eric introducing himself. He was the speaker, and he did one of these amusing introductions of himself. A couple of lines from it. Tonight's speaker is the first speaker we've ever had who suffers from severe incontinence. My father is Greek, hence my surname, Metaxas. My mother is German, hence my deep love for Siegfried and Roy. We'll be back with more of Eric Metaxas on the Kindlings News right after this. Don't go away.
Wow.
Thank you very much. This is Dick Staub at the Kindlings Muse, and we're joined tonight by Eric Metaxas, and we've got a whole bunch of questions for Eric, and we're going to get to them right now, and we'll try to move through them with dignity but quickly, because there's a lot of people that want to ask questions. And by the way, the rest of you, don't forget, we have a book signing coming up right after this, and so you can go out and do your Christmas shopping. Dan, what's your question tonight?
Who have you wanted to interview on Socrates in the City that has put you off or didn't want to do it for whatever reason, just decided it wasn't expedient?
That's a good question. I can't really think of anybody. Who has... Actually, Anne Rice. She does not travel. I guess she has health issues.
I interviewed her.
Well, you went to her, right?
No, she came to Seattle.
She came to you?
You can listen to that interview at thekindlings.com. Eat your heart out, Eric. We did it over at Como TV.
Incredible. Incredible.
So, yeah.
But I can console myself by knowing that it was a very bad interview. You did a terrible job. I remember specifically how bad it was. Incredible.
What are friends for?
In fact, it wounded her so badly, that's why she decided no longer to do interviews.
Okay, here we go. Dan, what's your question?
Seems like we need a Dietrich Bonhoeffer today in the USA.
Let me point out that's not a question.
Is he...
Oh, sorry.
Is he speaking to us today, and are we listening?
Well, that is the question, really, because I have to say that in this book, I felt that, in a funny way, God gives us a second chance. And in Bonhoeffer's day in the 30s, people did not heed his voice. And I really believe it was God's voice through Bonhoeffer. I think he was speaking prophetically. And so it is my hope and my prayer, and I've said this publicly a number of times, that we, the American church, would hear God's voice through Bonhoeffer so that we would not make the same mistakes that Germany did. And of course, we would never make exactly the same mistakes, but we will make similar mistakes because we're just as stupid and just as fallen and just as broken and just as sinful and just as capable of doing terrible things. So that's my prayer, and I hope that God will use Bonhoeffer's story through my book and through Bonhoeffer's writings to lead us to really hear what God has to say. So, do I think we're listening? Not yet.
All right. Shade, what's your question?
Bonhoeffer's faith didn't seem to come alive until he experienced the church in Harlem. Have most of our churches lost what the Harlem church had, and what did they have?
That is a great question, and it's true in the book. You
I
see
think
that.
What they had was the anointing of the Holy Spirit. There are churches and there are churches. Met my wife at a church in New York City called Times Square Church. That's David Wilkerson's church. And I've had the fortunate experience, the blessing of being at many churches where you know Jesus is in that place. They are not playing church. This is the real thing. And I have to say that anybody who's going to a church that is not is wasting his time. And I think there could be nothing worse than bringing your children up in a place that's mere religion, because it inoculates us against the truth and the fire of God. And I think that Bonhoeffer, when he went to that church in Harlem, obviously I write about this in the book, he saw people who clearly were really worshiping Jesus. They weren't just going through the motions. It wasn't just dead religion. And it just thrilled him and caught him up to see people who they live this, they breathe this. This is true. Jesus is alive, and they are, and he is alive in them. And so I think that that's it's an extraordinary chapter in his life. But I think that all of us need to be looking for churches and communities where Jesus is alive and where faith in him is alive and acted on, and it's not just religion.
Well, and Bonhoeffer wouldn't settle for less, and he made that same decision when he chose who he was going to study theology under.
Yeah.
Because he turned away from kind of a liberal person who didn't really know God and wanted to study with people that did.
Yeah.
Studied with both, but
correct.
He definitely knew what he
correct.
Was looking for. Dick, what's your question?
Has Hollywood shown any interest in making Bonhoeffer into a major feature film? I pray that they will.
The answer is sort of yes. I've been approached by a number of folks. Nothing has come of it yet, but that's because I'm being a little bit fussy about who I would assent to working with, because I think the story needs to be told in just the right way. And obviously, it could be told really poorly. I can just imagine a bad version of it, and we don't need that. So, there's been some interest, but nothing has come of it yet. Thank you.
All right.
And by the way, let me point out, I prefer true or false questions.
Or multiple choice.
Yeah.
The rest of you. Yeah, he's feeling really stressed about what's happening here. Alice, what's your question?
Well, my question has to do with Squanto. I've been reading it as a grandmother to my grandchildren, and I've always wondered if it's all truth or if that's partly fiction.
Actually, I'm happy to say it's absolutely true. The only liberties I take are very small liberties, like sort of imagining dialogue or something like that. But that's one of the, that's what gave me the confidence to do the Wilberforce book, actually, was that I remember working with these primary documents, and some folks don't know, Squanto is a children's book, but it's an amazing, truly amazing story about what happened to the pilgrims and the story of Squanto. And I was again amazed that I'd never heard this story. When I did the research, I said, this is insane. Everyone should know this story. This is a miracle of God. It's not sort of an interesting story. It's an out-and-out miracle. And I said, I've got to write it up. And so when I was working for Chuck Colson, I told him the story, and we did it for Breakpoint. And then I said, I've got to do a children's book. And I actually did had done a children's book where they had sort of edited out the God part. And so I said, I'm going to do another children's book where I tell the whole story. And Thomas Nelson published it, just like they published Bonhoeffer. And it is one of those stories that everyone needs to know it. And yeah, it's a true story, and I'm happy to say that. Yeah.
All right, Stan, what's your question?
Now you can read it with confidence.
True or false?
False.
Okay. Something. Please share, coming from your cultural milieu, please share tips for maintaining conversations across the cultural, political, and metaphysical divides that we find in our society today. In 25 words or less.
All right. Boy, that's incredible. I have no answer for that. Actually, this gets to the difference again between religion and faith in Jesus. Faith in Jesus is for everybody. Religion is just for religious people. And we all know religious people, and some people have an affinity for being religious and some don't. But Jesus is for everybody because he created everybody, not just people who like going to church or who, you know, like being religious or who have a moralistic temperament. And I think that we do ourselves and the Lord an injustice when we speak religiously and when we think religiously, because it puts a lot of people off. And those are the people that God loves and died for and wants to speak to. And so we need to try to express the things of God in the normal language of life. And I've always tried to do that. I mean, I didn't write the Bonhoeffer book for Christians to read. I wrote it for everyone to read. And so many Christians have read it, but non-Christians can read it. I speak to Jewish groups about it. I think we need to understand that truth is one thing. It's not, there's no such thing as like religious truth and then secular truth. 1 + 1 = 2. The author of that is Jesus Christ, but I don't call that a Christian equation, right? Every apple is the atoms are held together in the apple by Jesus Christ, but I don't say it's a Christian apple. I think that we have really confused the idea of truth, and we've painted ourselves into a little religious corner, and that's not God's will. We need to speak plainly about the things of God. They're either true for everyone or they're true for no one. And we have to be able to express ourselves again in ways that where we don't hide behind religious language or religious concepts. Reality is for everybody, and God is the author of reality. And Bonhoeffer talks about this, about Christ being Lord over everything, not just some little religious sphere. So anyway, I could go on for hours about that,
read,
and I won't.
Everything you want to know about God and we're afraid to ask, because it gives examples of how Eric views conversational conversations.
Actually, that's
about faith.
Thank you. That's true. That's part of the reason I wrote those books, is to sort of model a kind of posture toward the culture, to show how I would talk if somebody asks me a question about this or this or this. And because I think we do need to, it's not so easy, and we have some really bad models, we don't need that. So
but
thank
one,
you.
One thing that's important about reading that book as a way of understanding conversation is that, in my view, one of the most important things about communicating effectively in culture is your own authenticity and finding the way that you would talk about these things. I'm saying that because people will read Eric's book and then go out and try to be witty. And if you're witty, go for it. But if you're not, that's not your style.
Yeah.
You know. And so find who you are and what style is best suited for you.
And actually, to go along with that, part of what I do in the Everything About God books is that I think sometimes we've been trained wrongly as Christians oftentimes, that we think, I've got to have all the answers. I'm a Christian, so a non-Christian is going to approach me, and I've got to have the answers. That's nonsense. That's not truth is truth, whether you know it and can explain it or not. Now, it's nice to be able to give a defense or to be able to give that. That's really nice, and we should know what we believe. But you don't have to prove it to somebody, and you don't have to fake it like I've got all the answers. And you know, because you may not have all the answers. If somebody asks you, how can a good God allow suffering? Part of the answer is, I don't know. But that's honesty. And the honesty of saying, I don't know, speaks volumes to the person who's hearing that. And so we also ought not to feel the need to kind of put a button on the whole thing, that, you know, just have a conversation as though you're just having a conversation, not like you're trying to force somebody to believe what you believe, and try to let it flow naturally. And if you don't get them to pray the sinner's prayer at the end of the meeting, God is not displeased with you. And I really think that we've got a very bad model. It's not biblical. Let me put it that way. If it were biblical, I'd say go for it. It is unbiblical. And this idea that we've got to prove something to somebody, or we've got to answer all the questions, or we've got to force them to see, no, we don't. That's God's job, and we're to be faithful. And it's really, yeah, thank you. It's really... souls hang in the balance for us, you know, doing that the right way.
After you read Eric, you might want to read the New Testament and look at how Jesus did it. Because he basically never shared the same way twice. It was always contextual. It was always conversational. He never tried to take a person from A to Z in the conversation. He took them from A to B. And there's huge lessons in that. And that's where Eric learned what he does. Jamie, what's your question?
I guess that I read the book, Bonhoeffer, just so, so good. I just really enjoyed it. And after I finished reading that, I began to think, well, was it a common faith or uncommon sacrifice? A lot of us, you know, as believers in Jesus, you look at that and say, what does it take for that? Are we all capable of that? And that's kind of my, what do you see as that?
I think it's interesting because wherever I go, people say, who do you see as a Bonhoeffer today, or who do you see as a Wilberforce today? And I think that the answer is clearly, the biblical answer is that the Lord sees every one of us as chosen by him to do his will. We're all chosen to do his will. Now, the mystery of why some would or some wouldn't, but I don't think we can say it's not like... athletic ability, like that guy can high jump 6 feet and I just can't do that. It's not like that. God expects each of us to be obedient to him. And some people will be spectacular and stand out like Bonhoeffer because he was this amazing theologian from an amazing family and so on and so forth. And Wilberforce had certain advantages. But God, whatever the Lord has given any of us, he's given it to us for his purposes. And for us to be obedient with what he's given us is all he expects of us. And I think that there's not a person, I don't think, who ought not to be able to have faith and to obey God. I mean, there's a mystery there, but I really think that sometimes, because people have said they've read the book and they think, God, what would I have done? And I think, the Lord's only going to ask you to do what he's going to ask you to do. He's not going to ask you to do what Bonhoeffer did, because he created Bonhoeffer to be Bonhoeffer, and he created you to be you. And I think that we should never compare ourselves, but we should know that God created us for his purposes, and that whatever he's given us, that we are capable of doing with what he's given us, the same thing that Bonhoeffer did with what the Lord gave him. So,
all right. Jerry, what's your question?
In the book, I was really struck by how Bonhoeffer cared for his former underground seminarians after they were forced to go off to the war in the army. And I was just wondering if, other than Eberhard Bethge, I was wondering if there was anything known about their fate after the war.
There's tons of information on that. I don't have it off the top of my head, but many of them were killed. Many of them, unfortunately, were killed. Actually, I think I write the exact number someplace in the book. And many of them went on to tell stories about that time. I don't claim to have an encyclopedic knowledge of that, but the information is out there. You'd have to do your own research, but there were quite a few of them, and he really did show particular pastoral care. It really amazed me how he spent time writing letters to them and caring for them. So,
well, he's very attentive to relationships, something that we've been talking about.
He's very intensely relational.
Intensely relational.
Right.
That's right. Thank you. Lacey, what's your question?
How would you explain Bonhoeffer's idea of the living truth?
Of the living truth,
mm-hmm.
I think I know what you mean. But say a little bit more about that, so folks.
Like you mentioned that he wrote an essay about the girl that she was asked by her teacher if her father was a drunk, and it would be more truthful for her to say he wasn't, even if he
right.
was.
Right.
How do you explain that?
Well, because I think a lot of us have a very almost a clumsy Enlightenment hyper-rationalist view of truth. Like we think truth is a set of propositions, and truth, and we as Christians we ought to know more than anyone, that truth is a person. Truth is Jesus Christ. So to talk about truth as though it is merely a list of facts or syllogisms is not quite getting it. In other words, you can say, you can speak something that is true in a spirit of hatred, for example. And so in a sense, it's not spoken as, if I tell somebody on the street, Jesus loves you, you idiot, you know, it's like I've said something that's true in a way that is false. And I think the enemy traffics in twisting truth because he can't create untruth, right? You can only twist and pervert what is true. And in a sense, our concept of truth as Christians needs to be a little bit more developed than the idea that this is true and this is false and that's that. And so Bonhoeffer is getting at that in his book Ethics, and in a number of places he writes about this, that if the Gestapo comes to my door and says, "Are you hiding a Jew?" As a Christian, what am I supposed to say? Oh, yes, I cannot tell a lie. I am hiding a Jew. Please come and kill the Jew, right? As a Christian, Bonhoeffer would say, I have an obligation to protect that life. And so if it means telling the Gestapo, no, there's nobody here, there's a larger truth. Now, if somebody wants to take that idea and use it to rationalize lying and deceit, well, that's not what God's talking about. That's not what Bonhoeffer's talking about. But there is something beyond this kind of, in a sense, legalistic or I would say religious concept of the truth. To give another example, the one that you used was that Bonhoeffer uses the example of a girl in a classroom, a young girl being asked by the teacher, "Is your father a drunk?" in front of the whole class. Now, let's say the father is an alcoholic, but does that girl owe it to this ill-mannered, out-of-line teacher to say, "Yes, my father is a drunk"? It would be, in a sense, more honest of her, more truthful, more in keeping with her integrity as the daughter of this father to say no. Now, it's more complicated than we have time for here, but it really is not an excuse for relativism, it's not an excuse for situational ethics, but there is something deeper about the way Bonhoeffer talks about truth and the way I think God conceives of truth than the way many of us, again, with our Enlightenment rationalistic view, think of truth as merely facts or syllogisms or something. And that the truth of the gospel is that kind of truth. It's as Bonhoeffer says, living truth. And as Christians, I think we're obliged to understand that and to live that way. Otherwise, we become merely religious, and that doesn't honor God. So,
all right. Three more questions. Will.
Okay, I'm a grad student at the University of Washington. And I
true.
Also, it's very true. And I do have very much in my life existential angst all the time. And it's kind of a common occurrence, I think, in school. I was wondering how you thought about Bonhoeffer and Wilberforce and how they dealt with their doubt, especially doubt that debilitates. You mentioned floundering and floating and
yeah.
just feeling stuck sometimes in life.
Yeah.
How do you think those guys, and how would you address that?
I think two things need to be said. First of all, there are different kinds of doubt, right? There's doubt that is healthy, and then there's doubt that's destructive and of the devil. And I think we need to know the difference. I struggle, I suffer. I have certain kinds of doubts, but in the middle of all that, I know, as much as I want to know that 1 + 1 = 2, that Jesus loves me and that he's with me. And I think we can never doubt that, because to doubt that is like doubting that 1 + 1 = 2. It's an absurdity. Like, we need to know that 1 + 1 = 2, whether we feel like it or not. We need to know that the sun is a ball of gas 92 million miles away, whether I feel like it or not. Maybe I can't see it today because I'm indoors and it's cloudy. But it's true. And there are some basic things of Scripture that are as true or more true than those kinds of truths. And to doubt them is a kind of absurdity. Now, to say I don't feel it today, that's okay. And the Lord is with us in that kind of doubt and in our struggle. But I would never, if my daughter says I don't feel that Jesus loves me today, I can't pretend like, well, maybe he doesn't. I know that he does, whether you feel like it or not. And maybe I can't convince you. And maybe I shouldn't even try to convince you today. But he does. And we need to know these kinds of things that way. And I think that you can honor doubt too much, and you can honor doubt too little. Again, to have this rationalistic, fundamentalist idea of, you know, you've got to believe these things or whatever, that's also not right. In other words, there's some people that say, don't ask any questions. We're not talking about that. It's healthy to ask questions. But there's certain questions, you know, again, if somebody says, like, well, does the moon really exist? Is it really up there? Yes, you know, it is up there. Now, can we move on to something that's, you know, more complex? And I think that when it comes to things of faith, that it, just because we wrestle and we go through things or whatever, I think we need to know the basics, that the God of Scripture is real, and that the I mean, I can say this too, the amount of evidence for that, you know, is so overwhelming to me at this point. I mean, I was just having a conversation with a non-believer at a cocktail party in New York, you know, 3 nights ago, and I said, look, I can't answer all your questions, but this much I know, that it would take an infinitely greater amount of faith for me to believe that this is all about nothing, and that we arose completely by accident, and that there's no God and no purpose, whatever. That is infinitely harder for me to believe at this point than to believe that the God of the Scripture created me and loves me, and so on. So it's much harder. Now, doesn't mean I don't still have questions, but it is no contest. And we kind of need to know that, like, that what we believe, it is true. And so if you've got some little questions and stuff and whatever, that's fine. But, like, you know, don't, it doesn't mean that you have to question everything because you have some questions.
Good.
That's the long answer. Would you like the short answer?
True. Okay, Jack, what's your question?
I was struck reading the book this summer about the...
Who struck you?
By a feather, and it knocked him over.
I'm sorry.
The Moravian pacifists
struck
that struck, that were at the heart, evidently, of his grandmother.
Yeah.
And were also connected with John Wesley.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how did you feel when you uncovered that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what you're referring to, for those who don't who haven't read it or don't remember it, is that there's a connection. I discovered this. I was very interested that Bonhoeffer's the nannies or the governesses that spent some time raising him, that were very close, that were very important in his sort of religious instruction, were part of the Moravian group, the Zinzendorf group. What's it called? The Herrnhuter, I think, is the yeah. And it's a sort of a pietistic group. I mean, really serious Christians. And I thought that was really interesting because they had a great effect on him. And then I realized that the mother somehow, I never kind of got to the bottom of it, but that the mother had spent some time with the Herrnhuter. And so there was this pietistic influence. In other words, it wasn't all this kind of like, you know, high theological level stuff, or it wasn't just, you know, kind of mainline Lutheranism, but that these, I guess, you know, evangelical, today we might use the term, pietistic group had an influence on the whole family, and the mother obviously allowed it. I mean, she obviously hired these governesses to raise her children, and it just struck me as interesting and important. Now, again, I leave it to others, real scholars, to do more research because there's so much else to be uncovered, but that was very telling to me. It's unavoidable that's important, and to the extent that it's important, we can't say, but clearly it's important.
Michael, what's your question?
Okay, I named my youngest son Michael Wilberforce, and I read about 5 books on Wilberforce, and yours is my favorite one. And
true.
I've done a 2-page summary of your book, so people don't have to read the book.
Now, why would a bookseller do that?
So the question is,
he's a bookseller.
If Wilberforce was alive today, who would he be, or what would he do?
Joe Biden. Next question. If Wilberforce were alive today, I think he would be studied by the medical establishment to find out how he could have possibly lived 2.5 centuries. Is that what you mean? I think that it kind
of
gets
to my...
You have
a real gift of getting to the heart of a question, Eric.
I think that people often, I think I said this just a minute ago, but people say, you know, who's the Bonhoeffer today, or who's Wilberforce today? And I think that the answer ultimately has to be us. That's God's answer. That God says, you're no different. God's not a respecter of persons, and he expects each of us to be as obedient to him with whatever he has given us as Wilberforce was, and that there's an infinity of tasks. It's not like, oh, here's the one thing, we've all got to be involved in the pro-life issue or whatever. Everybody is called to different things, and there are many important good things, but God might call you to simply raise your child and to spend your time. You know, we're all called to different things, and we have to be sensitive to that, and the only way you can get the answer is by having a living relationship with the living God. He gives us answers that are not, they're not the cookie cutter answers, and that he doesn't tell all of us to do the same thing. So I think there's an infinity of worthy goals, but each of us has to determine for himself what is God calling me to do, and rest assured, God is calling you to do something. He's calling you to do whatever he's calling you to do with your gifts, and I think that these men are meant to be inspirations to us and models. They're not meant to be the kinds of examples that just make you feel bad about how mediocre you are, you know, because God doesn't see you as mediocre, and we need to know that, and I always feel it's really important to say that, because that's the way God sees these two lives, and that's the way God sees our lives.
You've been privileged to spend a lot of time with Wilberforce and with Bonhoeffer in their study of them, and then to be exposed to some major thinkers in the Christian faith. And obviously one of the reasons you're doing that is you want to get it out to more people. Mm. But I know from personal experience that when you have the privilege of being in the presence of those kinds of people, it does something profound to you. How would you kind of say that this work that you've been doing of exploring other people's ideas in depth has affected you and made you who you are right now?
Boy, that's a tough one. How many minutes do we have left? Dick, I'll be perfectly honest. I don't know. I'll be perfectly honest. I don't know. I think that we do what we do, and it affects us in ways. Sometimes we're conscious of it, and sometimes we're not. Bonhoeffer affected me a lot, I think, because he reminded me that the time is short and that we can always, you know, preserve our viability for some time in the future, but there's also at a point at which you need to just speak the truth and know that it's okay to do that and that it's really true and you don't have to kind of hedge your bets. And there's something about that kind of courage and confidence that touched me, I think, in a way that a lot of these other folks didn't quite. But, yeah.
Well, it's been fascinating to be with you tonight, Eric, and I thank you so much for being with us. Let's give a big round of applause.
Thank you.
Taxes.
Oh, thank you.
And,
my pleasure.
You've been listening to Kindling's Muse. This is Dick Staub, your host. We'll look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you.